ますか。
I said, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's alternative media, because basically nobody else really bothers to cover any elements of truth in this country to any realistic extent that it needs to. Now, speaking of extent that needs be, I have a very special guest for y'all today, ladies and gentlemen. I believe y'all is the parlance of Texas, but I'm not sure. His name is Leifer Thor, an unusual name for an unusual man. And as we all know in this day and age, being unusual is actually a very good thing, because if you are a usual person, you're probably some description of zombie. Leifer, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vince. Good to be here.
Give us a breakdown about yourself, mate, because there's a phrase here, open source ecology. Now, most of us know what open source means, where everybody kind of gets an interaction and it's more or less done for free in terms of a project or a website or something of that nature. But you're talking about open source ecology, farming practices and things of that nature. Give us a little bit of detailed background about yourself, and then we'll head on to the open source ecology.
Sure, no problem. I've been an engineer, an inventor, designer, information architect with a number of companies. My background is graphic design, which turned into engineering, strangely enough. And I have a patent for a light reflecting device that allows someone on, say, the first floor of a five-story building to have a skylight in their room, even though they're, you know, at the bottom floor of a very tall building. I came into open source ecology after hearing Marchin talk on TED Talks. And if anyone doesn't know about TED Talks, they should. It's a great resource to hear about new ideas and new concepts. And Marchin spoke on TED Talks, and he spoke about open source ecology, and he spoke about the global village construction set, which is what open source ecology is currently focused on right now.
Construction set. So let me just see if I've got the problem right here. If you want to do any farming in an industrial fashion nowadays, there's lots of very expensive equipment that you need to purchase, whether that be tractors or anything else for that matter. And basically, the whole idea is, in terms of industrial agriculture, as far as my understanding is, to sell you copious quantities of equipment at a huge extortionate price that will break down, which cost an extortionate price to fix quite regularly, of course.
Yeah, right.
And then when your crops are failing and all of that kind of stuff because you don't have the equipment to raise them properly, they tell you to use chemical farming methods. And then, of course, the soil all dies and you have to use even stronger chemicals, which cost even more money, and so on and so forth. Basically, the whole current dogma of industrial agriculture is let's destroy everything that we possibly can and make sure that people are left freaking destitute. Is that about right?
Well, that's certainly one way to put it. It's definitely a incredibly ineffective system. And I think you really exposed a lot of the ineffectiveness of it. If you have farming getting subsidies from the government, and yet the farmer is spending ridiculous amounts of money for a specialized tractor part that keeps breaking, it's just a vicious circle. And as you say, it doesn't really work. Open source ecology is really a natural evolution of what you might call big industry. If I say the word big industry, what comes to your mind? What's the first thing that comes to your mind?
U.S. Standard Oil selling oil to the Nazis so that they could bomb England. That's the first thing that comes to mind.
Okay. Does the idea of you being powerless come to your mind when I say the word big business?
Yeah, to a certain extent.
Or big industry.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of things like they sort of, I don't know, big industry, big business sounds very much, it resonates like big bully.
Exactly. You're exactly correct. And the funny thing is, we as over time have sort of garnered this resentment against big industry because of the controls that they put on people, which are tremendous. And they're a shame, and we should get rid of them quite naturally. That's a thing that needs to happen. But how do you make that happen? How do you begin to do that? And what's great about this is open source ecology is a natural evolution. In other words, if Marchin and open source ecology wasn't started, if he didn't start it, somebody else would. It is a natural evolution of industry that as we become more technologically advanced, we can take some of the primary foundations of technology that we use for anything, for farming or for building buildings or for, you know, whatever you can think of, and those processes can become much, much smaller. To the point where Marchin has very eloquently proven with a tractor that you can build a tractor for one-fifth, not half the cost, one-fifth to one-tenth of the cost of a tractor. And the tractor that you build for that one-fifth cost is going to hopefully have a much longer life because it's not designed with obsolescence in mind. It's designed for longevity, and it's designed with very specific design goals, like that it's open source, that it's low cost, that it's modular, that it's user servable, that it's do-it-yourself, that anybody can with certain tools can take it apart, that it's a closed-loop manufacturing, that it's got high performance, that it's got flexible fabrication, it has to have distributive economics, and it has to have industrial efficiency. And these are all of the things that none of the stuff that we have actually have. We have big industry designed for obsolescence, specialized parts, traveling long distances to satisfy our needs. Satisfying our needs is important, but we've evolved to the point where we can reduce those industry lines and close those loops. And this all probably sounds like the driest conversation you've ever heard, but the promise at the end is absolutely amazing. It's going to turn commerce on its head.
Well, I think that commerce has probably needed to be turned on its head for quite some time because at the moment, commerce, as far as I'm concerned, has been sitting on the lavatory. You know, and just basically pissing away all our possible productivity, all our possible profits. And any time that we do actually wind up making copious amounts of profits or making good food for people, Monsanto will plant, I don't know, a GMO crop next door, and then it cross-pollinates, and then they come and take your farm.
Right.
because you're growing crops you're not allowed to. And right. this open source ecology, there's two elements that I really wanted to talk about here. We talked before the show about keeping on the positive track. Now, I feel that you do need to enter into the negative track so that you understand the importance of being positive. Because it's the negativity and the information about the bad things that will or may happen to you in the course of your daily life where you can actually have a look and say, there is all this bad stuff going on. But on the brighter side, and that's what the show's really about, it's the lighter side of genocide.
Let's go there. Go there. There's lots of bad on the big industry side, I suppose I could mention. But yeah, if you want to look at the dark side, we can certainly look at that dark side of big industry. It's very large.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it does wield the force, much like Darth Vader.
Well, you can't, at the same time though, we can't blame companies. I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions that people have is they have a tremendous amount of resentments towards corporations. That's true. Corporations, and corporations, believe it or not, are very good at doing what they're supposed to do. We were the ones that that designed them so poorly. It was human beings that designed corporations, and it was the Queen of England that started it back with the East India Trading Company back in England. But when she started that, it was this idea to remove the liability of the ship investors, the people who were investing in the trade with the ships at the time. They wanted protection against the crew. If the crew were killed or maimed by pirates, they wanted to be held liably free. And so the Queen of England created the East India Trading Company, and they invented corporations, and that's how we got corporations.
And not just that, but she also appointed commissions, and that's where the rest of us get commissions from, is that it's basically a royal mandate to go out and commit piracy. And that's basically the two elements of the modern corporation that you need to take into account. Number
correct.
One is it's legalized piracy.
Yes, absolutely. That's totally correct.
And number two, legalized piracy with no liability for killing people.
That's as close to correct as correct. Yeah. I mean, you're right on. And at the same time, you want to hate corporations for the damage that they've done. I mean, you couldn't even count how many lives corporations have ruined over the last 300 or 400 years. But you can't blame them because they are doing exactly what we've asked them to do. So what we really need to do is we need to go in, we need to get under the hood, and we need to redesign commerce for people. So the problem is commerce isn't designed for people right now. Have you ever heard of, let's see, what is his name? Kurzweil.
The name rings a bell. Why does it ring a bell?
He's an inventor. He's the guy who talks about the singularity. Do you know this term, the singularity?
You mean like a black hole?
No, not that sense of the word. It's an economic singularity that we're rapidly approaching that's supposed to hit somewhere around 2024, where the collective computing of all of humanity will be smaller than the computing going on within a computer. So every year they keep doubling the amount of computations possible in a computer. They already have a date fixed.
Rather, they keep doubling the amount of computations that the public are allowed to have every year so that they can keep selling them new computers
that's a great example of designed obsolescence. Designed obsolescence is designing it to fail shortly after so that they have to buy a new one. And we're so ingrained with it. In other words, it's so deep in our economy that we actually don't even notice it anymore. And you wouldn't notice it unless you were put into an economy that didn't have designed obsolescence. And if you were put into an economy like that, if I put you into a society that was run that way, in a heartbeat, you'd see the difference. But unless you actually go there because we're so deep in it, it's very difficult for us to see that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, and there's the whole saying about you can't see the forest for the trees, and when people talk about corporations, and this is something that happens particularly on the left. I'm not saying that I'm right. In fact, they're both a frickin' big distraction and a lie anyway to usurp people's energy. But the whole manner, and I think you kind of put it, is that people are blaming corporations when the reality is they don't actually understand corporations, I don't think. It's more the fact that, hey, it's legalized piracy. That's the reason why they set them up. And now they're using corporations. And I'm talking about the New World Order, you know, the people who actually own the bulk of the planet at the moment and place their people of trust in the top heads of the particular corporations, whether that be World Bank, IMF, etc. Doesn't matter. We all seem to be operating under some description of hidden hand at the tiller. And my opinion is that if you're going to be attacking a faceless corporation, which has a CEO that is just interchangeable like Legos, there's no frickin' point, because they're just gonna put Humpty Dumpty back together again and then smash it again. What's the difference?
That's a great observation, and I totally couldn't agree more. I think you've really nailed it. You're not going to fight that kind of a paradigm by fighting it. You're only going to change that kind of a paradigm by creating another paradigm that simply makes the one that's in existence obsolete.
Yeah. Well, and again, this is the interesting part, because we talked about just before about planned obsolescence. Now, I think that we should plan the obsolescence of the current system in its entirety. Okay? It can be replaced, and it should be replaced, and so therefore it must be replaced. Now, what do we replace it with? Basically, you need something that mimics it, but takes away the ability for hidden hands to have inordinate amounts of control. And the way to do that, in my opinion, whether it be politics, business, or even kind of general social groups and whatever, is making them more open source. I mean, could you imagine what an election would be like if everybody actually was online doing their voting and then forming policies and forming discussion groups? You would have a lot more openness, and it would be impossible for any one person to control and dominate the entire population's voting habits, because everybody would have an equal say. Whereas under the current voting system, you don't have much of a say at all. You get to choose which corporate bankster-funded scumbag rules you. You're listening to The Vinny Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Lee Pathor. Back in a moment. Yes, we can be funded by bankers and then win the U.S. election. Welcome back to the Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and, incidentally, the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. My very special guest, Lee Pathor, joins us now from the USSA. Welcome back.
Hello.
Yeah.
The USSA, I like that.
I don't like it, because if I go into the continental US, firstly, I've got the choice of being microwaved like a like a guinea pig, and if that doesn't help, then they're very nice and they do cradle the balls. Thank you, TSA. I love that. And Texas is apparently going to be turned into a no-fly zone because they don't want people to be fondling little children's genitalia while they're taking holidays with their parents. And how dare parents, honestly, try to not get their children groped? That's just un-American.
Well, right.
Yeah. Have you noticed that we're living in a sort of an Orwellian society where everything is the direct opposite of what it says it is? You know, like president's supposed to lead the country into clearer waters, but, you know, his job's actually to drive the frickin' country off a cliff.
Yes, I am familiar with that. And it's very interesting, the history and where that all stems from and what its purpose is.
And in terms of practical solutions for this, and we're getting back to how people sort of attack nameless corporations or faceless corporations or whatever. In my opinion, when you're doing that, you're basically wasting your time. You're pushing Shiite Muslim uphill. It's not going to work, okay? Because again, like the Legos, they can just replace the head of that little model, and it doesn't matter what your actions are. Uh-huh. However, when we talk about, say, revolutions, for example, do you remember when Bechtel privatized the water supply down in Ecuador? And they even privatized the water that fell from the sky. Okay,
yes, people were not allowed to collect rainwater.
Yeah, and now you can't collect rainwater in Utah either, according to U.S. legislation.
You're kidding.
So if you think that if, you know, there's some tyranny in a third world country, if you think, oh, it's over there, I can tell you that it's only being done because a bunch of globalists are using it as a test case to then implement it elsewhere. And by elsewhere, I mean eventually everywhere. Okay? This is the way I see the world working. If you take the worst examples of anything that's ever happened in any country in the entire world, and then you assume that all of those bad examples tied together form a system of government, that's what the plan is for the Earth, essentially. If you're talking about...
Well, it seems to be what's going on now, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, the antithesis to this is the whole idea of open source, more individual responsibility, and more to the point, individual power. If you don't have the ability to make your own technology, if you don't have the ability to grow your own food, then you are essentially in every single way dependent on outside forces for your survival. And this is the reason why humanity, in my opinion, has become enslaved so totally, is that this whole kind of consumer society, and coupled, of course, with the prohibition of the cannabis hemp weed, that basically made everybody totally dependent on the state, dependent on corporations that own the state, and as a result, they don't have any power. And that's why everything seems to be going downhill, because we've taken all that power that a normal human being is capable of producing. They're capable of making equipment, growing their own food, being independent, generating their own electricity. That's been basically taken away. And we can see the result. So, the answer to this, obviously, is to take the power back. It doesn't seem like a very great revelation here. It's just pretty straightforward from where I'm sitting.
Yeah. Can I talk about that for a sec?
Yeah.
About that? Because that's actually a very interesting point of interest within the open source ecology. A lot of people, when they look at open source ecology, one of their first reactions is, "Oh, great! This is gonna bring down the man. This is gonna take down big industry," and they would be mostly correct. It turns out open source ecology can actually work side by side next to big industry, completely happy. Let me give you an example. It's 10 years from now, and you want, for some reason, you just happen to like Nike tennis shoes, and you like a particular kind of Nike tennis shoes. So you go online, and you look at the Nike website, or maybe you go down to your store that sells Nike shoes, if there's still one exists, and you look at that pair of shoes. But you really like that pair of shoes. You don't want to get an open source pair of shoes. You really like that particular brand. And it just so happens that if you look online, there's a guy in your community who has a specialty of building Nike's shoes for people. He's got a deal with Nike where he produces their shoes and then sells them locally. So you're in fact buying a large, big brand item, but from a local person who's getting profit to him that is then staying locally. And, of course, there would be some commission going to Nike. We don't know what that would be. But I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that open source ecology doesn't say that big business has to die. Again, it is a natural – this is much more a natural evolution of technology. It is a natural evolution of industry that 50 years or 80 years ago, it took a massive factory. It took 10,000 people to design a car. And today, we can do that with a much, 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 much smaller group of people more quickly. Not because we're any smarter, but because technology has advanced to the point where we can do more with less. And that's what open source really is at the heart of open source ecology and at the heart of the GVCS, the Global Village Construction Set, which is to make these items so that they allow communities to bring profit back into the community. But they still have lots of room for big business if big business wants to play in the OCE playground. But the main factor of OCE is that it empowers the individual, which is what you were talking about earlier. And that's pretty pivotal and key. It is really transformational to economics and to commerce in general.
Well, that means that it's a massive threat to the status quo. And in my experience, any threat to the status quo is often ruthlessly crushed.
Yeah, and I would say let's take another example of something that was tried to be ruthlessly crushed. The music industry and copying songs. So what did they do? They killed, what was the name of that company that used to do pirate?
Napster.
Yeah, okay, so they killed Napster. Have they killed pirated music? No. Have they disabled the ability for people to copy files digitally so that the copies
well,
are
actually,
exact replicas? No.
Well, actually, I've got some bad news for you. In September of this year, and they've already passed the law in the New Zealand Parliament, new copyright legislation will come in that if your computer, and they now have an installed tracking system, the police did it about 8 years ago, and they only announced it to the public 3 years ago, that they are tracking and tracing everybody in the entire country's computer activity. And the law that they passed is a new copyright law, where if you are seen to either view a video on YouTube that is copyrighted, download a copyrighted bit of music, they can shut off your internet. And in fact, they will shut off your internet and you have no defense whatsoever. And they can shut it down for a full 6 months.
Well, I would love to see that try to be practiced. I think something like that is in the past, there's a pattern that whenever technology is challenged to a state of ridiculousness, that usually the response by society is, well, that's just ridiculous. So you're not going to get that. Like, you can ask for that. You can try and get that, but you're just not going to get it because it's just it's not within a realm of like reality. You know?
Well, you know, I'm sure the Nazis thought that way as well when they tried to classify Jews as a race when they're actually a religion. I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, nobody will go along with it. But again, if it's enforced by coercion, it doesn't matter how ridiculous it is. There really does have to be a public awareness and a resistance organized to mad legislation in order to defeat it. To assume that the public will be intelligent enough to see madness when it comes on their door is in blatant denial of reality. After all, if the public actually did operate under that pretext, society would be nothing like it is today.
Yeah. Well, it's I'm sorry to hear that that such a law has been passed. I know that the freedoms in my own country have been whittled away to
even
toothpick.
Obama's given you even worse legislation in the US. He can shut off the entire internet in the US and automatically broadcast things to your cell phone and to your local TV and radio stations through FEMA, the emergency tests and all of that kind of stuff, all part of conditioning the public into accepting greater and greater government intrusion into your communications. It's far worse in the US, I can assure you. And it's just basically that they sort of like they set it up so that if the time comes where they do want to completely destroy everything, they can. Kind of like making a nuclear weapon, not because you've got anybody threatening you, but because you just want to be able to threaten other people.
Right. Well, the the good news, and this is why, by the way, I signed up with Open Source Ecology. I have looked for over 20 years for methods, methodologies, matrix, models, anything and everything I could get my hands on that offered any kind of a promise to genuinely change our future for the better. And there have been many ideas that have come along, but none of them until Open Source Ecology had any potential to actually make an impact. How can I illustrate this so well? The point you just made about how they can cut off everything. One of the biggest misconceptions about power is that people believe that power is held by those that hold the controller. So in other words, you don't own the power that's lighting the room that you're in. The power company owns the power that's lighting the room that you're in. So that makes the power company powerful and you indebted to them. But the reality is that it's not the power company that you're indebted to. It's not the power company that holds the power. The one that holds the real power is the one that holds the power lines. It is whatever is taking the delivery of said object to you, whether it's your water, your electricity, or your garbage. It's the throughputs. It's whoever owns the throughputs that holds the power. And this is the singularity around which Open Source Ecology is so amazing. Because it's all about decentralizing power. It's all about taking power away from large systems and putting them back into the hands of communities. And one of the most gross examples of how that directly benefits people would be the case of, say, eating at a McDonald's or eating at Jenny's restaurant. Let's say Jenny's restaurant in your neighborhood is owned by Jenny and she lives in your neighborhood. Well, if you eat at Jenny's, the money that you give Jenny is going to go to Jenny's family, it's going to stay in your neighborhood, and it's going to be recirculated through your community. The moment you step into a McDonald's and you pay that money, you might pay less for that meal, but you've done a very huge disservice to your community. Anytime you step into a
McDonald's.
A McDonald's or a, what's the word I'm blanking?
New World Order Burger.
No, it'll come to me. Company owns many of them, whether it's
franchise.
Thank you. My brain's blanking today on that. So franchise. So any time that we spend money in a franchise, whether it's Pottery Barn or anything, the moment you leave that store, you could have just as gone to the city limits of your city and thrown that money outside, because it's never going to come back. Or if it does come back, it won't be for years, and it'll be very diluted, and it'll be percentages. So
well, that you should say that, because the person who actually came up with the idea of franchises was named Big Bill Rockefeller. In the Old West, he was a snake oil salesman, literally. And he decided that it was too difficult and too much hard work to scam all the towns of the Old West by himself. So he franchised his snake oil salesman skills to a whole bunch of other con men and then scammed the entire West. And then, with all the profits, massive, massive profits, he started up an oil company. And that was the source of the Rockefeller old money. It's just like the start of the corporation is just legalized piracy. The start of the franchise is legalized theft. So again, if we have a look at the core substitutes that we have in society for reality, it's all just corporate theft and malicious piracy. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, all about corporate theft and piracy here. We'll be right back.
I got some so-called friends.
Welcome back.
Smile right to my face.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Join us in the chat room at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com if you dare. My very special guest, Leva Thor from Open Source Ecology, also has a number of other projects and ideas and business models and such that he gets into. But I wanted to just wrap up the whole open source ecology thing because here's the idea. You've got a whole bunch of kits for tractors and various other pieces of equipment that you can basically run a farm on. And if you start to use all this equipment, not only can you build it yourself, not only can you repair it yourself, but it's also remarkably cheaper and more efficient to run. Okay, and it means that you're no longer dependent on big agribusiness for the success of your little agribusiness. Leva Thor, welcome back.
Thanks. I think you just summed it up brilliantly. I don't think there's a single thing I could add to that.
Exactly.
You nailed it on the head.
Well, thank you. I'll just add that to the list of things that I've nailed on the head. In fact, and I'm actually being quite literal here. because that happens on the show a bit, and it's interesting you should say that phrase "nailed it on the head" because that actually happens a fair amount on the show when people say that exact same phrase about me. I don't know what it is. It's maybe because I've got vocab or something. You know, I can just summarize. I've got the gift of frickin' summary because stuff just makes sense to me for some reason. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't make sense to other people, but I can figure stuff out pretty quickly. The problem is, of course, that if I think that I figure something out too quickly, then I'll be going in the wrong direction much faster and going into destitution.
Right.
But anyway, wrapping up, we've wrapped up open source ecology. I think that's a pretty straightforward concept. And what's the website that people can go to for that?
It's opensourceecology.org. And from there, they'll be able to find a great deal of information. You could probably spend 4 or 5 days solid on our website and still not take it all in. Marcin is very prolific at documenting, and he's an excellent engineer at getting from point A to point Z. And he's leading this thing, and he's just doing a really, really amazing job over there. They are creating a micro industry out of thin air. We are creating a whole new economy that's never existed before. And I would like to just mention a word that I want to put in every listener's ears, which is externality. An externality is a term used in economics for anything that cannot be equated for with a dollar value. So the most famous case is the supersonic plane. And there was a time when the supersonic plane was going to land in every airport, the Concorde. And all of a sudden, it stopped. And it was only landing in New York. And the reason for that was a group of people finally took the airlines to court. And they claimed that the sonic boom that was rattling their windows was annoying. And they didn't want the plane to be landing in their neighborhoods because of that noise. That was the only case that I can think of off the top of my head where an externality actually dictated business. It's very, very rare. Externalities are usually things that are tucked underneath the rug and ignored. And one of the most hugest, I mean, this is really, really big, where open source ecology stands to be a real source of good, is that if you were to take your phone out of your pocket, if I asked you, where did each of these parts come from? What is the story behind each of these parts? It might turn out that there are a number of parts that were gotten from child labor. And you simply don't know, and you never will know. And you'd probably have to research it a great deal to ever find out. But that's part of a huge web of externalities that none of us ever see regarding big industry that open source ecology will directly affect. Because now, if you've got your phone, and your phone was from, say, Nancy down the street who makes phones, and you bought her model because it's great, and that's a open source ecology kind of a mindset or models, reducing industry to smaller lines, then you know the story behind that phone. And there are less externalities possibly there, less people possibly suffering to get that product in your hands.
Well, that means that there's less compartmentalization so that everybody knows what's going on. That
exactly.
weeds out the that weeds out a lot of the possibility for corruption in it
exactly.
And any kind of hierarchical structure, so it forces people to be collaborative rather than competitive.
Yes, it forces an intercooperative society, which is exactly what we should be doing. And strangely enough, it's what we're designed to do. Human beings are designed to be intercooperative. You know, most people think we have a big brain for tools or because, like, technology. The reason we have big brains is to communicate with each other. That's all. That was the entire reason why we have the cerebral cortex, is because the many nuances of human communication required it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd find that it's the smartest people in the world that are the best communicators. And they're not necessarily book smart or street smart or whatever. They're just capable of communicating very, very well and get along with other people who are very smart, who are very great researchers, that kind of thing. And again, it comes down to, ironically enough, compartmentalization again, where the current system is compartmentalized so that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Right.
But instead, the compartmentalization should in fact be the left hand working with the right hand. Okay, and that's the problem that we have really to change here, is that people, they don't see the connection, okay? They don't
yep.
see that a company started up with the best of intentions. They don't see how somebody at the top of that company can dictate how it's run and make sure that that company winds up hurting people. They don't see that. And it seemed very ironic to me, because if anybody does any mild research, you have a look at a lot of the major CEOs of Fortune 500 companies or people like, for example, George W. Bush. The reason why these people wind up getting put on huge CEO boards and stuff like that and whatever is because they're reliable screw-ups. Okay, they will screw everything up, and they will do it just because they're told to. Okay, when George W. Bush was was on the board of Harkin Energy, he was told, the Harkin is being involved and under investigation by the IRS, and if you have any information, that means that the share prices might plummet or anything like that. If you know any of that, do not sell your shares under any circumstances. The very next day, he sold 43,000 shares.
Exactly.
And that's the real crux of the issue here, as far as I understand it, is that if you have companies or corporations under this old model, where they have a hierarchical structure, they will automatically, by default, wind up with scumbags in there who are liars and thieves and dictatorial filth, more or less, who do not collaborate with other people, who simply prefer dictatorship because it's much, much easier, as George Bush himself said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And, you know, externalities in business, what most people don't realize is that externalities, in my opinion only, I'm just speaking for myself, but I believe that externalities take up the majority of any business far more than the things that are tangible property, such as vehicles or computers or employees. It's the uncountable things that are the things that define the success of whatever business or something like that. I would like to, I'm sorry, I'm going to gather my thought in a second here. Just let's move on to something.
Well, don't worry about it.
There's this thing with open source ecology that's critical for people. That's what it is. Okay, now I remember. So this is a very, 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 very important piece to get around open source ecology. And if I have nothing else on this show come across, this is pivotal. Back in the 70s, when car auto manufacturers started installing robots in their factories, it was, to some degree, the promise that we'd all been told back in the 50s and the 40s, you know, robotic futures, you know, hands-free future, it's going to make the future amazing. But instead, once these robots were in the car factories, the only result was that the town that the factory existed in now had a great deal of unemployed factory workers, and the factories were making a higher profit. So what was missing in that particular model for it to actually succeed, or succeed in the way that we always hoped it would succeed in a futuristic fashion, would be as if the employees owned the robots, which they don't, and they didn't, and they don't now. And that situation has come and gone. Now let's look forward to open source ecology. Let me be the first to suggest that there's nothing to stop big business from coming in and simply buying it. Big business could literally step right in and just buy open source ecology.
Well, and that's a big threat. And again, it goes back to what I was saying before about how corporations are naturally trying to shut down their competition by any dirty means necessary. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest from the Open Source Ecology is Leifa Thorpe. Coming up in hour number two, we're going to be joined for a panel discussion by Pam Killeen, the recovering vegan. And we're going to be talking about a little bit to do with your health, how to take care of it and protect it, and also how to, basically, and this will tie in very well with Open Source Ecology, put the big finger at big pharma and big agri business. We'll be right back after this very short break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. It's the show where we... Okay, I was going to make a joke out of that. I can't be bothered. All right, now, I've got another special guest, Pam Killeen, ladies and gentlemen, who co-authored a book with Dr. McCullough. Pam, what was the name of the book?
It was called The Great Bird Flu Hoax, and it came out in 2006 around the bird flu hype. And it's almost unfortunate that we didn't wait until the swine flu hoax, Vinny.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a bigger hoax, of course.
Well, and now there's an even bigger hoax. Oh, no, wait, I don't think it's quite as big a hoax now, but with this released virus in Europe, you know, through the cucumbers and such that they tried to accuse it of, when reality is... the only problem was that Spain was saying, we don't want any of your GMO foods or any of that crap kind of stuff. Get it the F out of our country. And then a genetically engineered virus, and it's been proven that it is an engineered virus, gets released and blamed on Spain. And now Spain's organic industry is dead and they want GMOs to replace it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, it's just like hoax. Whenever there's some description of any disease, as far as I'm concerned, that winds up making into the media, is a government-made disease.
Well, and they like to blame the countries that, you know, where they're trying to target, you know, like the Spanish flu, for instance. You know, if there's some sort of issue politically or geopolitically with a country, they'll just blame that country and name a flu after it. You know, it tends to be a historical problem, or there's historical precedence for that, at least.
Yeah, yeah. I can't wait for the Guam flu. It's going to be fantastic.
Run and hide.
Yeah, yeah. So we've got both of you on here. We've got Leifa Life of Thor from the Open Source Ecology, and Pam Killane, author of the great Bird Flu Hoax, come on for a panel discussion. Because one thing I really wanted to get into was the sort of health issues and how our health is more or less managed and governed by the globalists, and more to the point, how to actually inform yourself about these types of mechanisms, how they kind of lock together, and mostly, of course, to wrap it up with how people can really protect themselves. And I know for a fact that there's plenty of ways that to protect yourself. You know, you can either buy guns, buy food, buy healthy health supplements or whatever the hell, or start up income sources and revenue generation power and all of that kind of stuff to get yourself off the grid, make yourself more independent, read books, watch documentaries, whatever. Those are the basic things that anybody can really do. But the difficulty I find is that, well, it's not that cheap to start off in that direction. You need some kind of capital investment. Or, and this is the worst part, even if you did try to start saving up for them, the interest rates are going down so low and the inflation's going up so high that your savings get wiped out while they sit in your bank account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're talking about protecting yourself in terms of, you know, being able to produce your own food or have access to high-quality food, you're absolutely right. There are going to be expenses involved. And it sounds like Lafer has some fantastic solutions to this issue. But, yeah, there has to be some upfront capital involved in that. But when I'm working with people and teaching them about, you know, integrating nutrient-dense foods in their lives and supporting local agriculture and so on, I really just encourage people to go out, meet the farmers, witness what's going on at the farm, and make sure that they're using sustainable agricultural practices. You know, these a safe food supply is a local food supply. You know, we're not going to see, you know, bioterrorism happening among our small farms around our cities or towns. These are people who have a vested interest in producing very, very safe food because they're feeding this food to their wives, to their children, to their neighbors. And if somebody gets sick eating these foods, you're going to know who produced that food. It's not going to be anonymous like we see with the multinational companies.
Yeah, particularly the GMOs, and that's one of the things that's been really in the forefront of a lot of activists here in New Zealand, is that we don't have GMO labelling. And this is the difficulty. We often don't even have country of origin labelling either. And it turns out that all of that type of silliness that prevents people from really having a choice or being able to make an informed one, more to the point, that those are all conditions of quote-unquote free trade agreements. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, free trade, the word free translates as slave. So basically, all these countries are signing these slave trade agreements so that they can, well, inexorably get their population enslaved in some terrible grand extent. My personal opinion is that if we're going to actually change the government or change business or change media, The current government, current business, and current media will do everything in their considerable power to stop it from happening, which means that if you are going to start up an independent business, media corporation, or political party or something like that, you need to be totally self-contained, totally self-funded, and in my opinion, the whole idea of open source, whether that be open source ecology or whatever, seems to be one of those big Achilles heels that the establishment doesn't really have too much sway over, because it is direct participation of the people, whereas currently the system is built on a predication of people not interacting, people not giving a flying
F. What do we have going on? No, yeah, they're very, very passive because they really don't know, and the media isn't reporting on this, not the mainstream media anyway. But what we have is a David and Goliath story, and I'm very familiar with the GMO issues simply because, you know, Percy Schmeiser is a friend of mine. I know Jeffrey Smith quite well, and you know, the scientists with the Institute of Science and Society, Professor Joe Cummins and Dr. Maewon Ho, they're good friends of mine. So I'm fairly up to date on some of the GMO issues and some of the inner politics that go on in order to blindside consumers with regards to keeping us from knowing what's really going on behind the boardroom doors. I mean, here in Canada, we don't have labeling either, Vinny. It's largely basically a European phenomenon that there's any labeling whatsoever with GMOs. But our Canadian government has been very vocal in saying that they believe that Canadian consumers are too stupid to know the difference between GMO and non-GMO, and that is how they justify not labeling GMOs here in Canada. And essentially, it's just really because the Canadian government is in bed with the biotechnology industry.
Well, everybody seems to be in bed together, and that's the thing. And it's not like a nice slumber party where people are, you know, having pillow fights or something like that. People get hurt because these corporations are in bed together. I mean, take Monsanto, for example. And I apologize for the affiliates for using that cuss word Monsanto, but, you know, it has to be done on occasion. They've basically bought out Blackwater, which is now called Z, because everybody knows that Blackwater is a bunch of psychotic, ruthless, mercenary criminal scum, and so they just changed their name, and that's what companies do. I love it. No, I'm not Blackwater evil scum. I'm Z evil scum. Okay, we're much better. But anyway, Monsanto's bought them out, and now Bill Gates has bought huge amounts of shares in Monsanto. So we're talking about the most ruthless agrochemical business company who has huge amounts of lobbyists in the government, so many, in fact, that they've managed to convince them to pass a Food Safety Standards Modernization Act of 2005, I forget what it is, HR 42, whatever, that says that if you grow in an organic garden, you have to have a license. Like, seriously, if you have a garden in your background, in your backyard, and a cop finds out about it, they can give you a $5,000 US fine. And conveniently, and not too long from now, $5,000 won't be worth that much. You could probably pay it with the gold that you find down the back of your couch. But it goes to the point where you understand that we really are moving into a dictatorship structure here. And just like Malthus said, it's food that is the real crux of the issue here. If you control the food, you control humanity. And how best to wind that clock back.
I was just going to say something I was talking about before we took a break, and one of the biggest threats to open source ecology is that there's nothing to stop big business from coming in and basically buying it up. And so I just want to kind of put it out there that if you're a person and you don't like the status quo, and you don't like the way things are, it really is going to be up to each and every one of us to take an authoritative stance and to make up and to create the companies that are going to hold open source ecology. Because I can tell you this, if open source ecology does get bought or run by big business, that is a really, really sad thing, because it is really a tool that can change things for the better for all of us. And it would give all of the things that you're talking about, Pam, of the clarity of issue and the understanding and the knowledge of these products of where they're coming from.
Yeah, and I'm a city girl, but I had to study sustainable agriculture simply because I lived in South Dakota and Minnesota and I was surrounded by farmers. So I'm really fortunate that as a city girl, I've gone out and I've literally, you know, studied agriculture as an outsider, yes, but I've studied it to the point where I understand a lot of the issues that are going on and challenging agriculture throughout not just North America, but the world. And one thing that I see, Leifer, and I missed the entire conversation you had for the first hour. One thing I see happening being out in the trenches, because I'm very close to a lot of farmers, is the people are bonding together and they're starting co-ops and they're buying farm shares, for example. So now they're just buying cow shares and buying the right to get raw milk, for example, from a farmer to circumvent, of course, the fact that raw milk is illegal, but it's not illegal to drink your own milk. So people are buying cow shares. In other words, they're buying part of a cow in order to give them the right to buy raw milk. But it's just even further than that, though, they're not just buying cow shares, they're buying actual farm shares. And so they're investing in the farm and they're basically providing food to large cities like Toronto. And so, you know, and that, of course, this is run like a business and it's controlled by the people because they want this beautiful, biodynamically grown food from a farmer that they know and they trust. So I don't know, Leifer, if you've had any of those types of efforts, any groups of people from large cities, whether it's Chicago or L.A. or whatever the case may be, where they're looking at maybe investing in a project by using your company.
Well, we're at Open Source Ecology. We're trying to develop what's called the Global Village Construction Set, and that is the first part of Open Source Ecology. It is the foundation from which everything is going to come off of. But right now, that is the absolute 100% focus of Open Source Ecology, is the Global Village Construction Set, which is the 50 most important artifacts that make a society or a modern society go, and making them more locally, micro-indicizing them so they're local. So mm-hmm. you buy your brick maker not from some outfit in another country, but from, you know, someone either down the street or perhaps in the next town over. But it's the idea is more locally.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Vinny, your listeners would be right in touch with a lot of that, wouldn't they?
Bugger if I know, but
oh. No, I'd say they've been listening to you talk about a lot of these things for quite a long time now, and
well,
I think they're probably
somebody,
a cut above.
Well, I presume that they are, but just because somebody listens doesn't mean they take action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is what I want to get into. I mean, you guys take action every day and whatnot, and you do something that's real. You know, Open Source Ecology is real. The bird flu scam is real. Whereas I believe that if you're on a radio show or on television or providing any sort of infotainment, entertainment, whatever, I'm not sure what I am, but I think that it's not really real unless the people on the receiving end of the radio show, TV show, or anything, make it so. Okay, because other than providing people the choices and the information to go out and do these things, I accomplish nothing every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like to focus on the solution. I mean, you've outlined a lot of problems, and the problems that you're talking about, whether it's GMOs or government control, or you know, the international food system that unfortunately we've fallen victim to, you know, let's focus on the solution. And the solution lies in stimulating the rural economy, in bringing the farmers back into business. And the only way that's going to happen is for people to actually go out there and change how they're spending their dollar.
Well, let's say, for example, and this is one thing that I've had on my mind for a long time, the cannabis hemp weed. Okay. As soon as that got prohibited, the rural economy just basically crashed, and everybody started having to move into cities because there weren't any jobs. And I believe that the hemp industry would be the key factor in any rural revitalization project, because of the fact that it can produce over 50,000 industrial products off of the one plant. So I would think that if a open source ecology combined with a revitalized hemp economy was put into it, you would have people in rural areas being able to produce anything. Quite
actually,
literally.
One of the things that actually destroyed the small family farm was pasteurization in the early 1900s. Were it not for pasteurization, a lot of our small family farms would probably still be in existence today. So it was really that the pasteurization, and then coupled with the centralization of the dairy industry, that destroyed the small family farm. And one of the reasons why dairy is so important to a small family farm is that it generates a lot of money for a small farmer. Especially cheese. Farmers make quite a bit of money off of cheese, and of course they deserve every penny they make off of cheese. Especially, of course, if these cows are grass fed. So, if we could change, and this is one of the reasons why I'm a big fan of the Weston A. Price Foundation, is if we can change supply and demand, if we can actually even go further and change the law in and around the ban on raw milk, and make it and basically decriminalize it, if you will. We can probably get more small family farms in business.
That's two. This approach is a very interesting topic, though. Anytime there is something that would revitalize the rural economy, the government makes it illegal.
Can I ask you two something? I'm curious. If you felt that, if you think that open source ecology would be the step one, reducing big industries sway. And then step two is more proactive politics on the part of the people.
Well, you're dealing with lobbyists, though, Lafer. You know, you're dealing with lobbyists.
That's exactly right.
What I do, this is my strategy. This is what I've learned after, you know, 20 years of being involved in the health freedom world is falling on deaf ears, doing any kind of lobbying on a lot of these issues. If you're strong enough to do it, Lafer, all the power to you. What I do is I work at a grassroots level and I educate one person at a time. And basically, that's the method to my madness is to say, let's change supply and demand one person at a time, one family at a time.
That's right. Don't try and change a government that has hundreds of corrupt people. Just try and convert one person at a time, and eventually they'll become the government. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guests are Pam Killeen and Lafer Thor, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about, well, winging it, basically. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Because in a world so full of madness and chaos, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Speaking of friggin' nuts, my two very special guests, Lafer Thor and Pam Killeen, welcome back, guys. And
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Yes, yes. We wanted to continue on along this train of thought because what we kind of touched on here is it's usually comes back to the individuals to solve the larger problems. And I see that the problem, in a nutshell, is centralization, okay? Because everything's becoming centralized, it takes all the personal power out of any community, and they wind up just, well, basically being left into licentiousness or whatever, basically. Nothing good can come from centralization, in my opinion. And so, therefore, the solution is pretty obvious and pretty simple: localization. Wherever you see a major mega corporation or whatever, you can rest assured that there are basically 100 little local businesses that do the same job all by themselves without the need for a massive corporate structure. In fact, everybody just runs their own little shops and whatnot. That's what I think the solution to our society in its entirety really is. You know, if you have media, for example. That's what I'm trying to do with guerrilla media, is you get all these other people like bloggers and researchers, ex-journalists, basically anybody who's been working against the establishment by themselves for frickin' ages, put them all together to contribute to a central theme, so that way nobody's actually high-ranking anything. It's just somebody's providing a platform for all the other people to use, so you can destroy the mainstream media. Likewise, corporations, something like Open Source Ecology, for example, would wind up eventually, in my opinion, destroying mega agribusiness like Monsanto, because it takes all of the power out of their hands. And likewise, politics, I think, need to be more localized as well. Local body elections, in my opinion, are far more important than the national election, because at least in the local election, there's at least a slight possibility that you'll get somebody who isn't funded by New World Order bankers.
You know,
well, they
want
to... Go ahead, Lieber.
Well, I was just going to say, in addition to what you're saying, Vinny, localizing things or creating open source ecology, one of the biggest assets that it creates, in addition to bringing the profit back into the community immediately, is it makes the community far more robust environmentally. Environmentally robust in its waste management, but also in its ability to handle severe weather. So if there's an environmental, I mean, if you could imagine what happened with the hurricane and people couldn't get water for days and days, that would not happen in a local source economy. It just wouldn't happen. There would be all of the mechanisms necessary to provide solutions there in that, because they're not thinking to ask an outside source to fix them. It's a much more problem local solving asking model.
Well, and if people are worried about E. coli or Salmonella, Campylobacter, or some sort of terrorism attack on our food supply, it would just not be able to, it couldn't happen, because it would be so isolated due to the fact that these are small farms and you would be able to point the finger, you'd know the exact source, and very few people would be affected by it. It would be a very, very small percentage of the population that would be affected by it. So there are so many reasons other than just, you know, stimulating the rural economy that just it makes so much sense to support reviving the rural structure. And unfortunately, you know, the World Bank down controls the monoculture agriculture, controls the multinational industries that are out there, you know, selling the farmers things they don't need, whether it's biotechnology, whether it's fertilizers or pesticides or whatever the case may be. They have systematically basically sold farmers a bill of goods. They've conned them into believing that they cannot produce food without all of these inputs. And I parallel that type of analogy with big pharma and health, because you know the more inputs that they can sell us, the patient or the client, then the more money that they make. And so we see on both domains, you know, inputs, whether it's in agriculture or whether it's with regards to our health. And in both domains, they've proven that they have failed to show us that these systems are healthy and sustainable. They are not healthy or sustainable. And so what there is a backlash of people like yourselves and your listeners who are questioning these systems and saying, there has to be a better way. What is it?
Well, I feel that there's a sense of urgency behind this, and I refer this particularly to the last Great Depression, and that was when 90% of people lived in rural areas and knew how to grow their own food. And during that depression, approximately 10 million people starved to death in the continental U.S. Today, 10% of people live in rural areas and can grow their own food. And the economic crisis that's looming is far larger than the previous Great Depression. So the urgency for me is to get local food production up as high as possible, as quick as humanly possible, to prevent mass starvation amid the population during this economic depression that's coming.
Yeah, absolutely. It is the large system that's the most dangerous. There's a great model they use in economics class to demonstrate how complexity can damage things. They say, if you were to take a city block and take one lot in that city block, and we'll say there's no house in that city lot, and the rest of the people who live on that block can decide what they want to do with that empty lot. So they can decide to do nothing, and you get no benefits from it. Or they can decide to grow tomatoes there, or grow something else there. But the more you want to get out of it, or the more complex that lot becomes, you get more out of it, but you also run the risk or a higher risk of it collapsing. So any system that becomes more complex has a higher risk of collapsing. And so local economies totally kill that idea. They make an indestructible country by what you guys are saying, by compartmentalizing everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everybody can get their backyard chickens.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, no, they can't. And again, this is the thing. In Auckland, New Zealand, we just had. You guys are familiar with Agenda 21, right? The Commission for Sustainable Development.
Heard about it. I haven't studied it. No.
Okay. Well. In a nutshell, 1992 Rio Earth Summit signed on Prince Charles's private yacht off the coast of Rio. The New Zealand Prime Minister, the Jim Bolger at the time, and also George H.W. Bush, Bush Senior, signed this Agenda 21. Now, essentially what it does is it says that, well, there's a whole bunch of things that aren't sustainable, and so we need to put legislation in place to eliminate them all together so as to save humanity. These are things like industrial agriculture, medicine, mining, electricity, democracy, etc., etc., etc. It's basically a blueprint for a 21st century neo-feudal slave state, okay? And the Auckland, New Zealand, just recently had some legislation rammed through without any input from the public, even though the public were promised that they would have it, of course. I'm sure everybody can relate to that one. It basically means that this city of Auckland, which previously comprised of seven or was it nine independent councils, are now under the direct control of a centralized council. And I just heard from a friend of mine yesterday that all the rural areas within the city limits you now have to get licensing if you want so much as a chicken in your backyard. Mm-hmm. The power to license and the power to tax is the power to control and the power to destroy. And incidentally, the amount of licensing that you need in order to have any food and the amount of taxes that you have to pay on everything in the city are going up.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And they told us that the rates increases, you know, taxation by the central government, I'd probably say, is a nutshell for that. Land rates. They said that they would not increase them past the rate of inflation. But guess what? The council can make up their own rate of inflation. And so it really does seem to me that the whole rural ideology is being subverted by mega corporates who wind up in my opinion, have just seized control of the government and see any kind of independent rural community as a massive threat to their dominance. And
backyard chickens are a great example, simply because, you know, when you look at the bird flu hoax that was, you know, basically began in Asia, they blame the backyard chicken flocks. I mean, this is just absurd. You know, they're trying to basically control all the food under one system. And in Asia, there's a large multinational corporation called CP that basically controls the chickens in throughout that area of Asia. They're out of Thailand, I believe. And so, you know, they blamed the backyard chicken flocks and said they were the ones that were the source of H5N1. And it wasn't. It was some of the factory farm chickens and all of those, you know, bird jails that had been surfacing in China and other areas since the late 1990s. So they want to get rid of our ability to produce our own food. And I do though see people, you know, basically pushing back. They're you know, debating these issues. They're bringing the issue up in city councils to allow people to have their backyard chickens and so on. So there are people out there. There are efforts going on where people are fighting back and opposing some of these bylaws that ban having backyard chickens, for example.
Well, this is the thing. Politics is no longer separate from business, and business is no longer separate from personal freedom, healthcare, politics, etc. Okay, it is now all interconnected. Now, so it doesn't matter what you want to happen, and it doesn't matter if you want to sort of separate the issues, because I feel that they are inextricably linked, and you mm-hmm. cannot attack a corporation or a government for suppressing your rights without attacking both the corporation and the government for suppressing your rights simultaneously, because they're working together against you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely.
Or at least that's my opinion, and that means that all business people need to start getting political, and all political people need to start getting more business-minded. And this goes back to the personal responsibility, open source type government that I really want, at least, so that everybody's got ability to participate and nobody's got the ability to have dominance over others without the knowing full participation and consent of the public. Because in my opinion, if you look at any legislation that's being passed in the United States or New Zealand or any country in the world, they seem to inexorably be coming down from much higher powers. Bilderberg Group is meeting right now as we speak, and they are setting the world agenda. And so the only way that I feel that we can really subvert world agendas is subvert them in our own homes, in our own small communities. Otherwise, it's too big for any person to tackle.
I'll give you an example of something I'm working on here, Vinny, and in my city in London, Ontario. And we had Dr. Paul Connett come here. I've been working on the fluoride issue with a group here and doing some, you know, mainstream talk radio and so on to try and convince the mayor and the city council, you know, that we have got to remove fluoride from our city water. And anyway, so we had one of our members of the city council meet with the mayor just yesterday. Because we've been having a heck of a time simply because they're so misinformed, and the information they are reading is from people who are pro-fluoride, who have done no research other than considering all the benefits of all the alleged benefits of fluoride, which really don't exist, quite honestly. But anyway, so she and her husband meet with the mayor yesterday, and he didn't know that fluoride was a toxic waste product from the fertilizer industry. He has said to some people that I know that he thinks that we're all nut jobs, right? That we're all tree huggers and nut jobs, you know. And here's, we had Dr. Paul Connett who came from New York State. He came to London, Ontario to do a talk, and I emceed the event. It's on YouTube, and I really encourage people to watch this YouTube. It's 10 parts long, but it's really worth it. I mean, Dr. Paul Connett is a class act, and the man knows his stuff. He runs the website fluoridealert.org. And we only got two city councilors out to this meeting. This was in March, March 2nd. Two city councilors, that's it. And since we have stimulated a lot of interest on the fluoride issue, they haven't moved one iota. They haven't done one thing. They just keep saying fluoride is safe and effective. Fluoride is safe and effective. All they're doing is listening to lobbyists. That's all they're doing. They're not listening to common sense.
I would suggest it's not even the lobbyists. I would suggest it's much more a legal issue in the sense that they're trying to protect themselves from being sued. And by putting that product in the water, that enables them to do it. And so legally, it's their prerogative to protect themselves above protecting the people. And again, I would love to say it's because it's the mean old bad government or it's because of the corporations. But again, I would say these are objects that we have created that are simply doing what they've been designed to do, which is accumulate money and regardless of the path from getting from A to Z.
Well, they're there to protect industry. Bottom line, they're not there to protect us. Yeah.
Well, they're certainly there to protect themselves. In other words, the fluoride's in the water so that nobody can say they get sick and then they can sue the city. So the city runs the downfall is that everybody has to drink chlorine. Are they going to die? Someone says, no, they're not going to die, but it's not going to make them any healthier. Oh,
yeah.
Is it going to protect
just
us from getting sued? Yes. Oh, great. Let's do it. Let's do it. Well, I don't want to get sued.
It's a strange thing, when people drink the town water and it smells so much that you feel that you can't light a match in here. And it's like, bro, do you drink pool water with chlorine? No, you don't. Do you drink radioactive water that has come off from the Fukushima coast? No, you don't. But you sure as heck take fluoride that is come from the phosphate fertilizer industry that is radioactive, which leaches radiation into your water supply, and then you tell people it's good for their teeth.
Right.
You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. We'll be right back. Some kind of way out of here. Said the fluoride to the municipal drinking water supply guy.
But there was some success on that recently, I should tell you about, in Fairbanks, Alaska. They started a task force in March, and by June, fluoride was out of their water. So that is really good news.
That is great.
Excrement.
I've got cousins in Bend, Oregon, who are under the same thing. They're fighting tooth and nail the city because the city has introduced worse than chlorine. They put in chloramine. If you want to talk about a real bad product, that makes chlorine look like child's play.
So that must increase the disinfection byproducts and all the
Well, what chloramine does and why they're using it instead of chlorine is they can use less of it and it lasts longer, and it's harder to get rid of. That's why they're using it.
Well, to sum up this kind of fluoride debate here, I said something over the break that I thought really needed to be repeated to the audience, that reason why these councillors and people who are in the city, the mayors and all of that, are repeating all this crap and don't want to get fluoride out of the water is because by doing so, they would have to admit that, yes, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we've been poisoning you with industrial chemical waste for the last 40 years. Well, a lot of you have now got brain damage, and a lot of you now have cancer and other debilitating diseases that you will be living with for the rest of your life.
Yep.
And what I want to do now is I want to take the fluoride out of the water so that you no longer have that terrible effect on your bodies. The guy would just be freaking crucified no matter who he was.
Well, there's two things I can say to that, though. One is, number one, there are whispers of class actions going on in and around having fluoride in city water. So there may be some aggressive action, legal action on that front. Number two, I asked I asked Ellen Conant that question. You know, they'd be admitting guilt, so they'd be setting themselves up if they took the water out and admitted they were wrong, right? And what Ellen Conant told me, and this is Dr. Paul Conant's wife, who really was the one behind getting her husband to work on this issue about 12 years ago, and Ellen told me that when cities pull fluoride out of city water, that the people, they don't retaliate. They are just so relieved that they got fluoride out of city water. There hasn't been any legal ramifications as yet.
Yeah, that was actually what I thought would be the case. And there's a difference between what people fear and what's actually going to happen, particularly if you're a member of elected office. In my opinion, if you do something right by the people, it doesn't matter how bad you were in the first place. So as soon as you do something right, people start to love you again kind of thing, you know? It's like with the deliberate dumbing down of America and the rest of the world, I believe, is entirely responsible for the way that the country is being run at the moment. It's basically like a moron's playland, you know? You got the mega malls in between the mini malls and the mini marts in between the mega malls. It's just basically one, like George Carlin said, they turned paradise into one huge frickin' shopping mall. And in
well,
a shopping mall, there's not...
they're focusing on their wants, not their needs, right? Well, I mean, our ancestors focused on their needs.
Yeah, well, and that's the difference between modern society and previous society, is that the needs that you had were something that you actually had to provide for yourself. You know, you had to go and haul water, you had to knit your own clothes, you had to make your own soap and sugars and whatever the heck. And nowadays, everything's basically in a neat little bisphenol A package so that you can be feminized when you drink it.
Yeah, Vinny, in America, that's... That's packaged as
It's packaged as yummy. And this goes back to those what I talked before on the break about the two branches of humanity, those who care and those who could care less, you know. And those who could care less, in my opinion, are just basically the ones who have suffered the most amount of detrimental chemical and brain-damaging effects of all of the different influences in our environment, from electromagnetic radiation that comes out of every computer and TV set, which they obviously spend all their time in front of because they don't go out and play sport no more. That's why everybody's so freaking obese. And the other side of humanity are those who actually do care and go out there and advocate, and like Pam does, and, you know, hold meetings for people like Dr. Paul Conant. And of course, if you wanted to see, just on a side note, Paul Conant's presentation on fluoride, you can go to my YouTube channel, Mr. News Guerrilla Media, and you can just search Paul Conant, and there's the two-hour and eight-minute edited presentation that he did there, all in the one part for you.
You've got the one I did with Paul, or have you got another one there?
He actually came here to New Zealand, so I filmed his presentation that he did here, but I haven't seen your one, but I imagine it's he does the same presentation wherever he goes. So
pretty close. He's on fire. Like, this is one of the best presentations he's ever given. And when he was in London, we had standing room only, Vinny. There were 400 people there that night. It's the biggest presentation he's ever given.
Yeah. And I think it's because there's now generating a lot of hype around him. And have you noticed, guys, recently, that this type of discourse, the non-establishment funded, the non-establishment written type of discourse that we go on about, whether it be fluoride or ecology or Big Pharma or whatever, it's starting to really ramp up and explode and get extremely popular out there. And I think, well, basically the days are numbered for our masters.
Well, I'm on mainstream radio saying this stuff. I'm on a mainstream radio talk show here in London, Ontario, a hyper-conservative town, and they let me say these things on the radio here. It's amazing.
And their ratings probably shoot up as well, because I think that the general public hate being lied to. They're frickin' sick of it. And when anybody comes on mainstream TV and starts telling the truth, and the ratings shoot up like mad fire, and it happens every single time. Doesn't matter whether or not you're exposing climate cultists over here in New Zealand, as happened with an investigative journalist named Ian Wishart. As soon as he came on television and debated climate change openly, that show that they were on had huge amounts of viewers. And as soon as they went back to talking about the cat stuck up a tree, all those viewers basically bug it off.
And so
therefore what it says to me is that we have already won this information war. We're simply going through the motions so that everybody else will eventually, through word of mouth and through the growth of this alternative media type of reality, it only matters once it hits so-called critical mass. But on the other hand, I'm very conscious of the fact that it has never been the masses that make huge changes in society. It's always been that small, determined minority that try to lead them that do it.
Mm-hmm. You know, Benny and Pam, have you ever heard of a series put out, I believe it was by BBC, called The Century of Self?
Oh, it's one of my favorite documentaries.
Yeah, to any listeners out there, you can find this on YouTube, you can find it on Google Video. Please, please, please go see it. It's a very, very detailed description of the last 100 years and modern marketing and how the masses are manipulated through modern marketing techniques. And one of the most recent shifts in America, at least, I don't know if it's been global yet, but is this idea of getting people out of politics and getting them into the never-ending story of finding themselves through buying materialistic items. And so the theme or the model is that you need to continually update yourself because you're constantly evolving. So you need to constantly change your image. You need to constantly remind everybody who you are. These were ideas that 100 years ago nobody had any thoughts of or inkling because you were who you were. Now we live in a society where you can become somebody. You can wear all of the gear and you can look like the motorcycle rider, even though you may not own a motorcycle. And they've been successful in this methodology because what they're selling is freedom. They continually sell us freedom, but they're not selling us freedom. They sell us the illusion of freedom through that pair of shoes, through that whatever it is that you think is going to change you. And what I would just put out there as a suggestion is that what we really should put our eyes on for the horizon or aim towards is exactly that. We should not say any ifs, ands, or buts, and that what our goal should be is more freedoms, every kind of freedom.
Yeah, and they've done
answers. And I just wanted to interject.
Sexual freedom, emotional freedom, all of them.
I absolutely agree with you. But however, the concept is you can't sell freedom. It has to be earned.
I would disagree with that. I would tell you I can absolutely sell you freedom directly. I could sell it to you personally. That's what open source ecology's promise is. That's the main promise that open source ecology is. Sorry, I don't mean to pull away from the wellness conversation, but that is the main thrust of it, is that it's the first time that economics and commerce directly put profits into the hands of people outside of a large industry.
Once you have access to those type of things, then it becomes about protecting them from theft, from wear and tear, from any number of restrictions and complications that may take it away from you. And that's why I think, you know, I kind of reverse myself and I say, you know, you can only earn freedom. And you're actually right. Yes, you can buy things that make you more free. For example, purchasing a car allows you freedom of movement, which you never had before. You know,
right.
And I understand that concept. It's absolutely. You can buy things that set you free to a certain extent, but the problem is you still got to buy petrol from a big mega corporation. You still got to buy your power from one, and the people who govern how your car or your vehicles or any of that kind of stuff run. Hey, they can just license it away, and you'll never have access to it again. So again, it comes down to earning the society that we have, and we've all subtracted and given up all of our liberties for the sake of security, and we're going to get neither in the end, as the old saying goes. I'd like to thank you very much, Pam Killeen, and Leifer Thor, for coming on the show with me today. It's been a real pleasure, and we'll see you again tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks, Vinny.
Thank you, Vince.
Thanks, Leifer.
Thanks, Pam.